Isin. Isin is the patron city of the goddess Bo, who is the direct daughter to the king Anu and his concubine. So one of the sons and daughters who came down to earth. So God the Father, Anu, is in heaven, and God the sons, Enki and Enlil, are on the earth colony, and God, the daughters, you're going to come up with Nenherzog and Bo, and I think there's others, but the main gods, here's where we're at. And when you look at Isin, Bo is married to King Anu's grandson, Ninurta. And Ninurta is the second in line behind Enlil to kingship over their whole planet and, of course, whatever colonies they have. So you're looking at Bo being the daughter to the king, espoused Ninurta, who is the grandson to the king. Now, they lived so long, who knows what ages they were when they were espoused. But Ninurta could still be older than his, what is that, a great aunt, Bo? He can still be older than her because they just simply live so long. So anyway, Bo obviously was born on planet Nibiru and came down with her brothers and sisters. And looking at Isin, it is smack dab in the middle between the rivers Euphrates and Tigris. And what's happening there is the land between the rivers is mentioned in the Bible as the Eden. And there were four rivers for that fertile valley, that fertile land between them. And by satellite, you can see two ancient rivers, one on each side of the Tigris and Euphrates, that also dumped into the Persian Gulf, and there are your four rivers, two no longer visible, and these two. So between the rivers, everything was initiated on Earth. The first Earthling, which is a worker race for the gods, and the first everything, you know, trees with fruit, farming, irrigations and canals, shipbuilding for the rivers, transportation, and clothes, manufacturing, and schools. Everything we have in our cities, you know, without modern technology, they had in their cities. And I would bet their technology was ever-present inside their giant ziggurat homes. The step pyramids, which you can see are staggered out about every 50 miles throughout the Sumer in Mesopotamia, there'd be the ziggurat. It would be huge. The god would live in there, and the high priest would either live in there or come every day, and he would be the butler to the god who is residing right there. And, of course, he would be the go-between, the god and the earthling, as far as the ceremonies and rituals and all those things. Pertaining to those things. And the king would be the go-between the god and the earthlings when it comes to rules and enforcement and and also laws and policies or whatever would come from the king, directives, pardons, whatever it is coming from the king. That authority is brought down to earth from heaven. Enlil brought that authority down, this thing called kingship. And it started right there between the rivers, just like everything else did. So Isin becomes a very important, powerful city. And it shows up on the king's list many times, which is an ancient list of kings and very interesting. So if we go to slide 1A, you'll see, by the way, if you set your cursor on the picture, it'll stop the slideshow. But a brief description pops up, and that can block your view of that slide. So put your cursor on the opposite slide, and it'll continue to stop the slideshow and give you full view of the slide you want to view. So anyway, 1A, to view it, put your cursor over on 1C, and you can see 1A clearly. And what you're looking at there is an aerial view of a very old city. And that's in southern Iraq, as you saw there on that map, or in Iraq. Next one, 1C, a bunch of tombs looted. It's looting in Isin is just horrific. What would happen is individuals would go out there with a couple guys, and they just simply dig. And anything they find, they take to the antiquities markets and make some quick cash. And these artifacts, basically many of these artifacts, became available to the world by this method. And so it became a nightmare for the archaeologists what has happened to these sites. So if you look at 1E or the one next to it, you're seeing robber digs, looters, come in, and it goes for miles. I mean, there are thousands of these things. That's how big the city was. That's how important the city was for artifacts. And everything's buried. There is no huge mountain here. And it's not an easy thing to find. And it's spread out. So there's, I'm sure, many artifacts remain there to be found, but the archaeologists kind of put that one to the side. Okay, the one adjacent to that, you see the same thing. And, you know, these little mounds of earth are probably from just simply digging the holes. Makes a rough terrain. Again, more of the same at 1B, but what I wish to talk about is a very interesting artifact, 6C. And what you're looking at is earthlings down below, whether it be in military form or whatever form. You've got the earthlings down below. You have a very large giant above. I believe his foot is on an earthling. His left foot is standing on an earthling. And he's wearing a battle dress. And he's staring at a cone. And this cone is a ancient god's shem. It is called a shem. And it's the flying command module of a three-stage rocket. So if you can imagine our good old three-stage rockets, The first two stages were sitting, or the last two stages were for the fuel, for power and liftoff. So, and the top of one third of that rocket is the command module where the astronauts would sit, and that rocket would blast those astronauts into space. And that cone at the top would fly it wherever they wanted to in space, and then re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, and we would land them in the ocean. Their technology, you can see one landed right there. Now, did this giant king, this Nephilim king, come out of there? I'd say there's a very good chance of that, yes. But when you have an alien god, imagine, who's taller than this giant king. If you have an alien god who has a flying saucer or a flying rocket or flying anything, and I'm sure they had the intergalactic vehicles, and they had the just inter-Earth vehicles. So here we're looking at probably an inter-Earth, one for low atmosphere or low space. And it's landed right there in what looks like a battle scene, people dying around it and so forth. And what you've got is the gods flying above their mixed breed offspring that they appointed to kingship over the earthling. So you had the giant god who was living in that giant ziggurat in the city. Then you had the king, who is a semi-giant, semi-divine mixed breed between the gods and man. And there's a little quote from the Bible, Genesis, on that. But you had the mixed breed, you had the who's a semi-giant, and you had the earthling. So the earthling's around, let's say, 5 to 6 feet, to be generous, probably. And the king, or the high priest, which is a mixed breed offspring of the gods, appointed to authority positions over the earthlings, acting as a go-between, you know. The gods got a buffer right there. They used it. And these mixed breeds, Nephilim, they should be loyal to those gods. And if they're not, they made a large mistake. And there you would have each city-state would have its kings, and they would go through and they would kind of change supremacy from city-state to city-state to city-state. After a period of time and so many kings, they move it to another city-state. So kingship came down. It moved around where these pyramids are, the ziggurats, where the gods are residing. And all of a sudden, you've got earthlings and Nephilim. Nephilim running things. The god is flying above, making sure his Nephilim and other Nephilim of the gods are protected, especially in battle. So imagine you have your own air force that's protecting you personally, and you go to battle after battle after battle, and that air force is knocking down all the defenses of your enemy, and you basically walk in and clean up. It's a fairly easy thing for that king to become conqueror of the entire Sumer or Mesopotamia area, whatever part is developed at that time. So you would see that change hands through the years. And of course, each one of these giant kings, like you see standing there, each one of them, Inanna, the goddess of love and war, would espouse that king. And so all through time here in the BC range, An important king is supreme in the area, and Nana is a spouse of that king. An important king isn't yet, she's still espousing that king. And Nana is basically a widow who was very devoted to her young husband, Dumuzi, who gets killed, and she just simply espouses everybody and becomes known as the goddess of love. She also will be at the front line of any battle, kind of like this cone is showing you. She would be there fighting for her semi-divine king. Now, that semi-divine king might not be her son, but it's her king. You see what I mean? So the god is protecting the king, who is having victory after victory and getting stronger and stronger, and things are getting easier for the god. He just operates through one guy. Everything's running as the god wants. Okay, let's go through this a little bit. We have Nenensina is another name for bow. So here is a temple hymn to her. Temple is the ziggurat residence of her right there in Isi. And you can see that from that aerial view. Then you have the lament for Nippur, which you can find on Nippur as well. It's a two-star must read, which means one star, it has some information in it. Two stars, it has a little more. Three stars is you got to read it. You just got to read it. And come back and read the twos, and then come back and read the ones. But as you read these texts, you're picking up information. As you listen to this audio, you're picking up information. Bo, she was a medical doctor. Bo was a warden under the name Gula. Her son, Damu, is a medical doctor. So those two, they're working on gods and the black-headed earthlings, or mixed breeds. They're keeping them alive, and they know how to do it. So, and there are artifacts of that effect on Bo's page. This is Bo's patron city. Connect right direct to Bo's page, and you've got the full story that I can give you of Bo. Her kings, her, and so on. And the texts that I can find the translations for. So, this is, I'm not bragging, but this is the best collection of texts and artifacts actually organized and brought together in a manner that you can understand it. Because the way our museums and our governments and our universities, elite universities, the way they handled it, it's secret knowledge. And this secret knowledge has been hidden from us for at least 2,500 years. The only reason we know about it at all is biblical archaeologists in Europe decided they would start digging in the Middle East area and see what they can come up with as far as cities that are mentioned in the Old Testament or Torah. So they're out there from about 1860 or so on through the early 1900s, and they're looking for tells, which are mounds that stand up uniquely and where there is plains. So on in the middle of the plain, the land between the rivers, there would be these mounds. They would start digging out the soil. Somehow these large mounds are buried in soil. So the archaeologists would remove the soil bit by bit, and they would discover some amazing things. And when they get enough of it out of there and they get to the city, they will discover a library that is loaded with cuneiform tablets. Excuse me a second. These cuneiform tablets are wet clay that they took a stylus to, and they just poked into the wet clay the characters that give us the very first written language on Earth, called cuneiform. So here we are with the very first civilizations on Earth, with the very first texts on Earth, with the very first artifacts on Earth, and lo and behold, you can find through this hidden artifacts I am showing you here, you can find the difference between the giant alien god, the semi-giant Nephilim king or high priest, and the regular size, I guess, Earthlings. So as the Earthlings increased in population, the other gods would have sex with these Earthlings and produce their own Nephilim. And if you're a commoner god, or just a worker god, you're doing the labor, and who has no females at all, he has sex with the daughters of man, and now there's all kinds of semi-giant mixed breeds. And that's perhaps is where you get the Greek tales and so forth. But here in Mesopotamia, we're talking about the beginning. We're talking about the very beginning symbols, such as some over above this cone. And these symbols pertain to the gods. And these flying machines pertain to the gods. And these Nephilim giants are obviously pertaining to the gods. And somehow Neanderthal caveman became Homo sapien. Now, if you're an evolutionist and believe in that evolution, which makes sense, except for if they follow the evolution of man, there's a huge area, a period that's just absolutely missing. They can find no skeletons or remains of a long period of evolution. I'm talking about like a million years of evolution of man is missing. And caveman just skipped and became civilized man living in a city, organized as our cities are, with streets and so forth, with governments, with churches, okay? Same thing, schools, the whole thing. That's where we get it. We got it from them. Everything we know, we got from them. So here are these massive structures, and the cities vary in size and importance. And you've got 300 of these alien gods that originally were doing all the mining for the gold, which is why they came. And you've got about 300 of these alien gods in the Garden of Eden setting up the colony, which was also hard, very hard, intensive labor for these gods. And then you had about 300 of them that's running the gold smelted out of the Garden of Eden. They would space trek it to Mars. And they set up a way station there, so there'd be structure there to, you know, to reside in. There would be warehouses to warehouse the gold and whatever else they would bring back to their planet. Now, their planet is Nibiru, and you can go to Nibiru page and learn a lot more about their planet. But their planet takes an elongated orbit, and it's been captured by our planet, so it's stuck in our solar system. elongated orbit takes 3,600 years approximately for them to have one complete orbit. As it passes into our solar system from way out in space, we're the seventh planet coming in, lucky number seven. The sixth planet, this lucky number, is number six, and that would be Mars, and of course Venus would be number eight. So if you see an eight-pointed star, or a seven-pointed star, or a six-pointed star, you're getting the point here. The stars are planets. How many points are on that star? You count from the outside of space in towards the sun, and you can see what they're talking about, which planet they're talking about, when you've got a star in that artifact. Such as when you look at that cone, above it are many stars. Well, those are symbols representing different things. Okay? So as we go through this, you'll see in artifacts many symbols. You'll see the variant sizes. There's three races of beings here on Earth colony until the flood, which wipes out the middlemen are supposedly wiped out, but they start up again. And they would marry their sister, which is demanded if you want an heir to be king. Or if you want an heir of, it's a god who wants an heir of his bloodline, so he'd be the direct heir to whatever power and position he had. Now, to have his offspring have the exact same benefits and position as he would marry his sister and have her as his official wife. And from his sister, he would produce a male offspring, and that would be immediately his heir, because he qualifies, this baby, as the law of the double seed. The Anunnaki had to succeed the king. All successions were going through the double seed law. And which means, for instance, King Anu has a son, King Anu has a daughter, they get together and have a son, well, that's their heir. So this is how this works for them. And quite frankly, as shocked as you may be, the first 10 generations from Adam down to Noah, they all married their sister. If they had no sister, they married their half-sister. If they had no half-sister, they married their first cousin. If they had none of those, they had no heir. It's just that simple. So if you married your sister, or half-sister, I guess, depending on how you look at it, and had a male by them, you've got two from the same bloodline, producing one, which is one of the purer bloodline. And because that one is of the double seed, nothing is diluted. And none of these advantages through the DNA gets diluted. So they're still taller, stronger, faster, smarter, and live much, much, much longer than the Earthlings. And they all have positions of power. Very important. So the first 10 generations down to Noah married one of those women. Noah had no sister, had no half-sister, so he marries his first cousin, Batanos. Excuse my pronunciation. And what you have there is the kingship or hero, Hebrew hero, whatever, whichever line you're looking at, it's working the same way. So the hero would come in and produce an heir, and you'd have another hero with those advantages, and he'd produce an heir until you start diluting that DNA, and all of a sudden man is now living 120 years and less. Where if you go to the king's list, and I'll show you in a second, you'll be shocked. So there's many shocking things on this website. The next 10 generations, from Noah on down to Abraham, did the exact same thing. They married their sister, half-sister, and none of those you marry your first cousin. Abraham, for example, married his sister, Sarah. And you can find that, of course, right there in the biblical text. And they had no heir. Abraham had no heir, no son from his sister. And so his sister offers him her servant girl as a concubine. Abraham produces a son. Now Abraham has a son. His name is Ishmael. Next, angels come and tell Sarah she'll be pregnant again. They are giant mixed breeds. They live a long time. So she gets pregnant at age 100. You know, supposedly everybody's shocked, but think about it. How did that happen? It's because they live a long time. So at age 100, she has a son, and they name that son Isaac, or Isaac. Now, Isaac is born of the double seed, Abraham and Abraham's sister. And Ishmael is not Abraham and a concubine. Therefore, even though Ishmael is much older, probably 10 years older or so, he is not the official heir of Abraham. And immediately you've got his sister Sarah, the mother of the heir, going, Ishmael needs to go. Send her out of this city and banish her into wherever they, who knows where they went. But under Ishmael becomes the Arab nations. Under Isaac continues the Hebrew line, and from the Hebrew line comes the Christian line, and you've got them both under Isaac, and then Abraham. So both Christian and Jew are under Abraham, and the Islam and the Muslims, the Arabs and others are under Abraham through Ishmael. So all three of the main religions on earth, the father of them is Abraham. And he married his sister, as did all of his predecessors. And they all lived a long time, and they all were in positions of authority because they were faster, larger, stronger, smarter, lived longer. And they all had positions of authority over the earthlings. If you abused your authority and didn't follow your directions from the God who's living and traveling and, you know, in and out of the place, and you're not following his instructions, you're going to have a problem and you won't be king. And then all of a sudden, kingship moves to another city state. You see what I'm saying? You can have a dynasty for a while and then it shifts to another city state because someone messes it up. So here are some ancient texts. And you can see there's one two-star, which is the Lament for Nippur. It gives you a little hardship story about what's going on in Mesopotamia. It's interesting. So I gave it a two-star, and I think you should read it. in the Wiedner Chronicles, one star. Next comes the mixed breed Nephilim Kings. And these are the kings that are throughout Mesopotamia. There's a complete list, a one star I give it. And the Sumerian, Sumer is the very first civilization of city-states in Mesopotamia. So Sumerian kings list, I gave a triple must-read, triple star. I don't do anything crazier than that as far as trying to coax you to read something. This one will shock you, and it's very important. So important that I did all that to emphasize it. Then here comes a little passage from Genesis talking about the Nephilim or on the earth, also after. Sons of God and daughters of God came down to earth. Some of them had sex with the daughters of men, and they had offspring. That offspring became the heroes of old, the men of renown, because that offspring, like Methuselah in the Torah, Old Testament, lived 1,000 years. He had an heir, lived 1,000 years, had a bunch of other children, and that's all you know about him. I mean, that is the shortest story of 1,000 years I ever heard. And there, that's how it goes for generation after generation in Genesis. But over here in Mesopotamia, you get a lot more of that missing detail in historical value throughout thousands of years. These things have not been available to the public. Some were intended to never be available. The ones that give you a clear picture of flying apparatuses and giant Nephilim. And you can see why some religions would not like you to know this. And other institutions of government and so forth would not like you to know this. But because they know it, they have power. And out comes this saying, knowledge is power. You ever wonder what that is? Here it is. Because there's a thing called the Knights Templar who discovered this knowledge and tried, and that is the first time it reappears, and they discovered it under the Temple of Solomon, hidden in the passageways there. And they discovered all kinds of artifacts in the Temple of Solomon. And if you look at Solomon closely, you see that he has aliens that help him, and he has alien artifacts like his ring and, of course, the Ark of the Covenant and so forth. This is alien technology. None of these powers we have in control today want you to know anything about alien technology or aliens. So all of this has been hidden from you, and the people who have to know are the people in power. It didn't work very well for us. In the beginning of Christianity, they used a dead language, Latin. And the only way you could read that Bible was in Latin, and that cut out all the people. And the priests would have to specially, particularly learn that Latin, and they would keep the Mass alive, and they would keep the reading of the Gospels away from the people. Knowledge is power. So trust me, and here's some pictures on the wall and some statues, and trust me what it reads. Until this guy named Luther comes along and says, hell with that. And he converts, translates it into German, and then from German to English and other languages, and now the power that the Catholic Church held over everybody, over the mass, as they speak in foreign tongue, that power has now gone to hell, thanks to Luther. Anyway, there are historical events like this, and they all go back in their original form to Mesopotamia, to ancient Sumer. So when you read these Sumerian kings lists, please take the time and do so and pay attention to it and believe it. They do not make these historical artifacts and make them last for thousands of years for nothing. It's for future generations of earthlings that would understand it. I guess that's us. So we have discovered them in the 1800s and early 1900s. We started translating them properly in about 1969, somewhere in there. Oxford, Yale, Princeton, UPenn, they're holding these texts. Museums hold these texts. It's all split up, so you can never, one text is six tablets, you won't find six tablets together anywhere. One's in New York, one's in, Sao Paulo, one's over here in Paris and London. You see what I'm saying? You are not supposed to put this puzzle together, and the obvious pieces of the puzzle are hidden. You never see them. Okay, and that gives them power. So here's the Nephilim. They're the heroes, which means they are the first kings. Okay, here's another quote from Genesis, and that is, and the Lord said, hey, let us... Knowing man is, he's knowing good and evil. What's that mean? Man is becoming knowledgeable of who he is and what's going on. He must not be allowed to reach out his hand and take also from the tree of life. Someone, mainly Enlil, is complaining these new breed of race of people are living too long. So we need to reduce their years, and they don't dilute their bloodline. So slowly they start to reduce the years. And then after the flood, there's a big reduction in years. And you can learn all about it in that triple starred must read Sumerian Kings list. You'll understand it clearly what happened. So here we go on down. Ishbi era, that's a giant, semi-giant, semi-divine Nephilim king. That's what we're talking about there. And he's a descendant, long time, long down the line descendant, of Enlil. Okay, and because he's a Nephilim, he's appointed the kingship position of power. That's how long he reigned. And here you would find different texts pertaining to Ishbi-Era about the gods from Ishbi-Era or including Ishbi-Era. Some of these texts are written by the gods. The older ones are definitely written by the sons of God who came down, daughters of God who came down. The first major scribe on earth was a female named Nisaba. She also had another responsibility. She was the goddess of grain. Her husband, Haya, was the god over the stores and the barley god and so forth. All these gods who came down had their realm of responsibility. And as the heavy load of labor got shifted from the back of the gods to the back of man, they would be instructed through these demigods. And here we go, Ishbi-Era being one. in different texts to Ishbi-Er, you've got one start. At least Shu would be the next Nephilim king in the Isin that I have available for you. There's one text and it's one star. But there's some information about Shu Elishu. Eden Dagon, here's his information, and we've got a little bit of a slideshow. If you hit the refresh button, the slideshows will start from the beginning, which is the best way to view them, because I do put them in somewhat of an order. So if you'll hit refresh, you'll see artifact number one, and that is a four tablets of list of kings. That's that Sumerian kings list right there. And look at that. That's an old text. It's written in cuneiform. And you've got information, some of the first written information about earthlings right there. I consider that extremely important, and I definitely read it. Next, one adjacent to it is a list of kings from Isin on a separate little wet clay tablet, fired hot, so hot that it becomes like rock and lasts for thousands and thousands of years, luckily, for us to of our modern age to discover, later translate, and then later, I guess through the underground or whatever, these things become available to us and now organized and illustrated for you right here on my website. First time that people from all over the world are seeing things for their very first time, because it's hidden knowledge. It's other people's, I'll call them Masons, it's their power structure. Hidden knowledge. Governments have it, religions have it. Okay, the next text is, this is where Inanna, who is the goddess of love and war, she's marrying one of these giant mixed breed kings. And what you find is this is how she begets the nickname or mark of the goddess of love. She gets goddess of war, of course, from putting on her battle gear and actually getting in the battle. But, you know, she's got alien technology, and odds are she's in the air in a flying machine. Maybe not sometimes, but she is very skilled in battle, even hand-to-hand battle. So it's not wise to mess with the goddess Inanna. I strongly, you will be very surprised at what you find. Please go to the page, says Inanna. And there are two pages there, lots to see in the slideshows. But when you get to the end of it, at the very end, very last slideshow, is you'll find quite remarkable if you're in the, well, no matter where you come from. It'd be very interesting to view that. Okay, the last one on under this Eden Dagon is you actually see a statue. And as you can clearly see, that's a giant. So maybe the earthling he's ruling over is 5-6 feet. This guy looks to me like he's about 10 feet. And of course, his mother or father, or grandfather, what have you, his alien god bloodline goes back to a full giant who came down or was born here on Earth, because some of these king descendant females came down too. The gods started having offspring, and some of them are females. And so now you've got a few more royal female walking around, female Anunnaki walking around for other Anunnaki to marry. And therefore, you'll get more Nephilim female walking around for these Nephilim kings to marry and continue on with the advantages of the bloodline. You may hear of movies very important about Muhammad's bloodline or David's bloodline, King David, or Jesus' bloodline. It's very important, bloodline. Always has been. The king's bloodline always has been. And it comes from the gods. Whatever we hold important or do that is necessary to hold a proper civilization in place, they already did it way back. And we're just rediscovering how smart we were back then. Coming straight from the cave. We were Neanderthals. No, now we're in Dagon. What an amazing sight. He doesn't look like a Neanderthal to me. And what year is this? You know, you're looking at 2000 BC. Huh? That's 4,000 years ago. Earth is only 6,000 years old. No. The Nephilim might be 6,000 years old historically, but these history records go way back, and the Nephilim are many hundred thousand years old. Shocking. Go take a look at that text. Okay, there's Eden Dagon, and we've got a couple texts here, a one-star, and a two-star. Praise poems of Eden Dagon. These are must-reads. You've got some information on the one, more information on the two, and good information. I mean, very good information on the three. So it may be just very good on this, or very good on many things. But there's very good information in there. Next is Ishmi Dagon. He too is King of Isin and a Nephilim. And comes from the double seed of somebody. So he's, again, Enlil's descendant. So we're probably talking about this dynasty that we're just going through, okay? So Ishmi Dagon is definitely part of that. And there are many texts under Ishmi Dagon, if you can see there. But let's look at the slideshow first. The first thing is an artifact from him, and there's a description of it that pops right up. The second one is it's a long, tall artifact, and in that inscription, you will find out information about King Ishmi Dagon. So this is all pertaining to him on this one. And next, these are cones. These cones are simply a model of the command module that these earthlings are seeing blasting off and landing. You saw one earlier that was landed. So they would shape cones, and they would write texts about a king on these cones. Here's an Ishmi Dagon cone and another Ishmi Dagon cone. And, you know, a little description. And that's it as far as the artifacts that I can find on Ishmi Dagon. As far as the texts I can find on him, they are here. And it looks like a two-star Right off the bat, I had a bad day in Mill for H.B. Dagan. And then some one stars all the way down. You got another two star and a three star. Inanna in H.B. Dagan. What do you think happened? Did Inanna marry H.B. Dagan after the old king dies or relinquishes kingship? Inanna is in the picture. Somehow she gets in whatever year it is in Earth's history. She gets in the picture. She's of all. And she was born on Earth. Some of these gods were the descendants of those who came down. Definitely were. Those who came down were born on Nibiru. Okay, so Ishmi Dagan, there's a three-star down there about self-praises. Him talking about himself. These are your very first historical records that have survived. Okay? Some of these that are strictly pertaining to the gods may be a rewrite. Where in Babylon, it was told this way. And in Kish, it may have had a little variant there the way it was told there. So you'd have a version one, a version two on some of these texts. Some are older than others by a couple thousand years. All of them, anything that we have pertaining to these kings, plus gods, or just simply pertaining to the gods, pertaining to grain, I'm not interested, pertaining to, you know, how many sheep we've got, I'm not interested in that stuff. I'm trying to show you the Nephilim and their relationship to the alien who came down, had sex with the daughters of men, and produced Nephilim. Here is our first history on Earth, first written documents on Earth that survived, first artifacts on Earth that survived, and the first city-states on Earth that have been found. Next is Lepidishtar, and the beat goes on. And the only thing I'm finding on him is this cone. Next. Lepidishtar has got even a three star, and guess what? It's Inanna and Lepidishtar. The text seems to always get more in depth with Inanna in it as a subject. Anyway, as you go through this, you'll see a self praise, another three star. Here's what he says of himself. And his position with the gods and with the earthlings. That's important to me. He's talking about his position with the gods. The middleman. The one where authority was given to act as a go-between. So the gods have a buffer between them and the primitive earthling. Safety's sake and many other reasons. Next is Ur-Nannuta, or Ur-Ningursu, and he obviously is named after the god Nannuta, but he's Adad's son, who is Nannuta's uncle. Okay, Adad is Enlil's brother, a son to King Anu, an uncle to Nannuta. And here is the Nephilim king named after Nannuta. It's complicated, but it's not. Once you see in your mind, you've got the god in that huge pyramid. You've got the high priest being the butler for that god and handed down the ceremonies and religious rituals to the people. And then you have the king receiving his instructions from that God, and he has the authority of rule and so forth, laws and rule over the people. And also, his power is based upon the success of that city-state and his conquering of others. So, one God is favoring one king, while another God is favoring another king. One king may have to wait for his turn of power. So, there becomes lots of these Nephilim, eventually too many, and things have to change, and you'll see them starting to change. Now it's shorter lives, and we'll go to the king's list. You'll see exactly where it changes. Okay, Ur-Nannerta or Ningirsu has a couple artifacts. Here's a bust. I think it has something to say. Ur-Nannerta. Okay, next. Ur-Nannerta text, two star, one star. Next is Enlil-Bani. This is the end of Isin, I'm sorry. Enlil-Bani, he's the Nephilim and he's Enki's son. But he's king of Isin, where Bo is. You see, no matter which god's offspring it is, he'll find a position of authority. It may be somewhere else, but he's going to find and be appointed to a position of authority. If he's Enki's son, he's going to have authority somewhere over the earthlings. Okay, this should give you a good explanation of Nephilim, of gods, and if you continue looking at these cities, you will continue to see many very good artifacts showing you the god, the Nephilim king, and the earthling, primitive. Very important if you wish to understand who you are and where you come from. Others who see these things and it offends them, please stop. Leave the website. This is not for you. There are two ways, I guess, to reach heaven. One is through knowledge, one perhaps through faith. Here we're providing the knowledge. I do appreciate it very much that you have come to my website. Please come back. Each city is important. Each god is even more important. And this knowledge is extremely important. So important, they hid it from you. Well, thanks again. I appreciate you coming.